Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Monday, the 8th of July, these are our main stories. Greece's Socialist Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has admitted defeat in a snap general election and will hand power to the New Democracy Party of Kyriakos Mitsotakis. The diplomatic row between the US and the UK has intensified as President Trump criticizes the British ambassador to Washington over leaked memos. And Boeing has lost a multi-billion dollar order from Saudi Arabia for its 737 MAX aircraft. Also in this podcast,
Mandla Maseko described himself as a typical township boy from Pretoria who'd been taught to confront all challenges he faced head on.
The man chosen to be the first black African in space has died in a road accident before having a chance to make the journey. Greece's Socialist Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has been heavily defeated in a snap general election that he called to try to consolidate his position. Mr. Tsipras telephoned his rival, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, of the centre-right New Democracy Party to concede and to congratulate him. And with most votes counted, Mr. Mitsotakis has nearly 40% and is on course to win an overall majority. Mr. Tsipras' Syriza party has just over 31%. Mr. Mitsotakis, who will take office on Monday, promised to grow the economy and create more jobs.
I'm very, very grateful for the result. We won an outright majority, which was our main target. We almost reached 40%, which is an incredible number given the context of a fragmented political landscape. And I feel that I have a strong mandate to deliver on my agenda, which is an agenda to grow the economy, to create more jobs, but also to make sure that the Greek people feel safe again.
Syriza appears to have been punished by voters for accepting tough fiscal measures imposed in exchange for an international bailout. James Kumarasamy spoke to the BBC's Kevin Connolly, who is in Athens, and began by asking him if it was a bigger win than expected.
I think roughly where the opinion polls had been suggesting, maybe a little bit better, Jamie. And I think, you know, Mr. Mitsotakis gave you a pretty good analysis there of why he won. Just that sense that by turning to New Democracy with the promise of better management of the public finances and a greater commitment perhaps to economic growth, that a sense of security might return to Greek public life after very, very difficult years, of course, under the financial bailout. And there's no great euphoria on the streets of Athens, so far at least. We were out and about meeting people from both parties, Syriza and from New Democracy. They'd gathered in pretty small numbers. There was an exhausted feel to the whole campaign, I think, some of the time, and election day itself was extraordinarily hot. The temperature was climbing up towards 40 degrees. So there's no great outpouring of joy. Everyone knows life is still going to be difficult. But I went down to the New Democracy rally, and I met two young women who I think give you a sense that bubbling up underneath the calm surface of life in Athens is an excitement at this moment of change.
I personally am very pleased because the past years in Greece were really difficult for us. I believe that it is the beginning of a new era, a better one, and that the years that are coming are going to be very nice and pleasing.
It's very tough for young people to get jobs in Greece. Do you think that Mr. Mitsotakis can make a difference to that?
Yes, we think so. And we're waiting for a better result for Greece.
Hope then, Kevin. Now, what's the analysis you're hearing from Syriza?
I think Syriza knew all along it would be very difficult because Mr. Tsipras is going to be remembered as the man who said he would stand up to Europe, said he would reject austerity conditions attached to a financial bailout, and then had to accept them. So it's possible that the die was cast for him as long ago as 2015, when he had to make that startling U-turn. He says they'll regroup and transform Syriza and come back as a different movement.
Kevin Connolly in Greece. President Trump has said the British ambassador to the United States has not served the UK well, after leaked messages revealed Sir Kim Darroch had described the White House as dysfunctional and incompetent. The British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt said the ambassador had been doing his job, but that the government viewed Mr. Trump's administration as highly effective. and he said he didn't share Sir Kim's assessment of the Trump administration.
They are personal opinions, not the opinions of the British government, not my opinion, and we continue to think that under President Trump, the United States administration is both highly effective and the best possible friend of Britain on the international stage.
Our North America editor, John Sopel, told us it was a very unusual situation.
It is exceptional. Leaks happen all the time. Not a slew of diplomatic telegrams which have the most limited circulation list to find their way into the public domain, into a national newspaper and picked up around the world, causing huge embarrassment to the Foreign Office and arguably fundamentally compromising our ambassador in Washington, Sir Kim Darroch, from being able to do his job.
And isn't the invidious nature of this for the Foreign Office such that they cannot be bullied by any country as to who is their man in Washington, but nor do they want a headache with such an unbelievably important ally as the United States?
Yeah, I mean, there is real skullduggery going on. And we've seen a lot of that already over the whole Brexit negotiations and the votes that have taken place and some of the behaviour of certain ministers, you know, along the way. This is a public servant. I mean, the diplomat has gone to be Britain's representative in a foreign country and is doing that as a public servant, not as a politician. And so it's unusual that someone like that is being played in a political way, because it looks like it is an effort to get that person out of the job. And so there is a whodunit, but why did they do it? And that's the really fascinating question, with what benefit at the end of it? And there are theories that range from there are ministers who are so disaffected with him because they think he is a pro-European and kind of against the agenda of Brexit, through to maybe this is somewhere. I mean, the only person that Donald Trump has expressed an interest in being Britain's ambassador to Washington is Nigel Farage, who he once said would do a great job. He tweeted it just after he'd won the presidency. Maybe there is some kind of idea you get Nigel Farage in. And I've spoken to senior Foreign Office people today who don't think that is far-fetched.
John Sopel. One of Europe's largest banks, Deutsche Bank, is to cut 18,000 jobs over 3 years. It's part of a radical reorganisation of the German bank. And I heard more from our correspondent, Damian McGuinness, in Berlin.
It's a huge amount of jobs that could go. And yeah, we've seen a disastrous time since the financial crisis, really. What we're seeing now is a real change of direction for Deutsche Bank, because it's not just about slimming down its workforce and saving money on its payslips. It's really about moving away from investment banking. So what Deutsche has announced today, and this is what has been suspected over the past week, really, but has really been confirmed, is that they're going to stop trading and selling equities. They're going to stop relying essentially on high risk global finance. And they're going to go back to their core market, their original roots, essentially, of appealing to Germany's domestic corporate market and providing services to big German companies. So it's a complete shift. It'll mean a smaller Deutsche Bank. It'll mean a more focused Deutsche Bank. And it'll mean one that's pretty much giving up investment banking.
It reminds me
a little
bit of
the new manager, the new CEO, has decided is just too risky and is too much of a loss. And since the financial crisis, has just actually been dragging Deutsche Bank down. What we saw in 1999, it tried to become a sort of European rival, as you say, Joe, to the Wall Street giants like Goldman Sachs. Didn't really happen, didn't work out. Partly that's also bad timing, because it was okay for a couple of years. But then, of course, we saw the financial crisis, 2008. Business, banking business in general became tougher. In the Eurozone, of course, we have rock bottom interest rates. So it means that all German banks are really struggling to make a profit. But particularly Deutsche Bank has been hit by a number of scandals. Both have hit the reputation, but also have meant huge costs in terms of legal costs. We've seen a probe into whether Deutsche Bank was negligent when it came to money laundering. And also we've had raids about tax evasion. So Deutsche Bank has been struggling reputation-wise, but cost-wise, and now has decided to jettison investment banking and go back to its corporate German domestic market, essentially.
Damian McGuinness in Berlin. China has rejected evidence presented by the BBC that it's been deliberately separating Muslim children from their parents in the western region of Xinjiang. In an interview with the BBC, China's ambassador in London, Liu Xiaoming, said there had been no forcible separations. But confusingly, he said the government was taking good care of the children and their parents could see them if they wanted, suggesting some families had indeed been broken up. China has detained perhaps a million Muslims, mostly ethnic Uyghurs, in re-education camps in Xinjiang in an effort to stamp out terrorism and extremism. Our East Asia regional editor, Michael Bristow, told me more.
To step back a little bit, Xinjiang, western region of China, over the last few years, the Chinese authorities have been putting into detention hundreds of thousands of ethnic Uyghurs. These are mostly Muslims. The Chinese authorities are doing this because they say they're battling terrorism, extremism, religion in that area, and they have to give these people training. That's how the Chinese authorities refer to it. Other people say they've been sent to re-education camps. Now, in the process of these, a lot of these adults have been separated from their children. They've been put in camps. And over the last week, the BBC has uncovered evidence about what's happening to these children. We've spoken to parents in Turkey. These are Uyghurs who have managed to get out of China, don't know what's happened to their children back in Xinjiang. And also we've spoken to academics who have been tracing what the Chinese government have been doing in Xinjiang, and they've found that the number of kindergartens in Xinjiang, these are places not just where children go in the day but where they can sleep overnight, have been expanded massively over the last few years.
The Chinese ambassador to the UK has been speaking about this issue, has he not?
He has. The Chinese ambassador, Liu Xiaoming, he went on the Andrew Marr show and was asked directly about these children, what had happened to them. Are they being forcibly separated from their parents? He said no, quite categorically. This is exactly what he had to say.
The children, you know, the government take good care of children. Well, you know, in Xinjiang...
Are they separating forcibly parents from their children in Xinjiang?
No. If they want to visit their children, they can come back.
This is all just
China.
Lies, is it?
Yes, definitely. There's no separation of children from their parents, not at all.
Even if there is separation of children in China, what is the international community ever going to do about it?
That's a difficult one. This is a really big story. Hundreds of thousands of people being incarcerated in prison-like conditions. They don't appear to have any rights. They don't appear to have any end date to when they can come out. The outside world has brought this up with China, but it hasn't yet gained massive traction in foreign capitals. Perhaps that's because other things are going on. President Trump of the United States, perhaps the country you would expect to speak out about this kind of thing more than anybody else. They're embroiled in a trade war with the Chinese at the moment. So the Chinese are just continuing with this campaign. They've got some reaction from the outside world, but not enough. Not enough, certainly, for them to stop what they're doing.
Michael Bristow. According to a new report from the German Interior Ministry, there are 25,000 extremists at large in the country, half of them capable of violence. Most are from the xenophobic right. It's less than a month since a politician from the ruling CDU party, who has supported refugees, was shot dead by a neo-Nazi. Meanwhile, in eastern Germany, the right-wing populists of the Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD, party are experiencing a surge in support, as Paul Moss reports from Dresden.
A casual passerby might easily mistake it for a village fete, albeit one oddly placed outside a city centre railway station. But this was a rally by Pegida, the anti-Muslim protest group, which began its life here in the city of Dresden. And amidst the traditional German folk songs and beer hall atmosphere, a seething rage is being expressed.
Many, many people comes into Germany, and the most of them are Islamics. These people make Germany an Islamic country.
What sign can you see that this has become a Muslim country? Because for a visitor from outside like me, it's pretty hard to understand.
They want to build mosque and his culture in Germany.
The square outside Dresden's main railway station right now is a sea of German flags and also banners. One of them in front of me is actually in English. It says, "Islamists not welcome," and it shows two Muslims running away from someone on horseback. It says, "Stay back or we'll kick you back." But a lot of the posters here also attack the German Chancellor Angela Merkel for allowing refugees into this country.
She brings many million people to Germany. What has she done for German people? Nothing. She is producing a war.
Producing a war, that's yes. Very strong language.
She wants German people destroyed.
Any talk of war is particularly sensitive in Germany right now, because just a month ago, an official from Angela Merkel's ruling party, the Christian Democrats, was shot dead at his home. Walter Lübcke had publicly defended the decision to let hundreds of thousands of refugees into the country. And the man accused of killing him turned out to have a long history of far-right extremism.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Surap Gula is all smiles when we meet, but she serves as a regional official for the Christian Democrats and has herself been receiving death threats since the Walter Lübcke murder. And when I ask what's behind the current tensions, she blames the right-wing party, the AfD, or Alternative for Deutschland. It almost came top in the state of Saxony by standing on a strongly anti-refugee platform.
One of AfD leaders, Alexander Gauland, have said, "We want to hunt the German chancellor." You have people who take these words and want to make it real, you know, and this is the problem. The threats are against me, and sometimes you cannot sleep, it's true, but you must learn to cope with it.
AfD television adverts are all swelling music, sunlit German landscapes, and a call on people to be daring and vote for something different.
Trau dich, Deutschland. AfD.
At the AfD offices in Dresden, I met their parliamentary secretary, Bernd Lömmel. He's impeccably polite, apologises for the quality of his English, and then Mr. Lömmel explains to me why refugees represent a threat to Germany.
In Africa, they're waiting 100 million people to get a better life. There come 1 million, 2 million, and it's too expensive to pay for it. The Christian Democrats have done a very big mistake, and more people support the AfD.
Bernd Lommel from the far-right AfD in Germany, ending that report by Paul Moss. Also in the podcast...
Keep an eye on the dog.
He's right here underneath this wheel. If you look right underneath the crane, he's right here underneath this wheel.
We head inside the exclusion zone at Chernobyl in search of the dogs that are still surviving there years after the world's worst nuclear accident. A Saudi Arabian airline has pulled out of a planned multi-billion dollar deal to buy at least 30 Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. The model remains grounded worldwide after being involved in two fatal crashes in the past year, Grant Ferret reports.
The Saudi budget airline Flyadeal announced last December that it intended to buy 30 Boeing 737 MAX aircraft with the option of buying a further 20. At full price, the deal would have been worth nearly $6 billion. But with Boeing still trying to implement changes which will satisfy aviation regulators, and no clarity about when the 737 MAX will be cleared to fly again, the Saudi firm has changed its mind. It now plans to operate solely with planes made by Boeing's rival, Airbus, and hopes to begin taking delivery of a fleet of new A320s within the next 2 years.
Grant Ferret. Malta has said that all 65 migrants on board a German-flagged rescue ship will be allowed onto the island. The vessel, Alan Kurdi, arrived off Malta's coast after it had been denied access to Italian ports. Gens Lamani has the details.
Malta's Prime Minister said that following discussions with the European Commission, all of the rescued migrants would be brought ashore and relocated to other EU member states. And in recognition of the Maltese government's goodwill, EU member states will also take at least half of another 58 migrants rescued in a separate operation by Malta's armed forces. Earlier, the Alan Kurdi's crew said three of the migrants on board had collapsed and required urgent medical assistance.
Gens Lamani. If you've seen the hit cable TV series Chernobyl, you won't forget the scene. Soviet soldiers in the exclusion zone around the power station shooting the pets of people who've been evacuated after the world's worst nuclear accident. The series leaves the impression that they managed to get every dog and cat. But, as our correspondent Jonah Fisher reports from Ukraine, the truth is very different.
Keep an eye on the dog.
We're hunting dogs in Chernobyl's exclusion zone.
He's right here underneath this wheel. If you look right underneath the crane, he's right here underneath this wheel.
The dog we're watching now is pretty tame. It will take food from the hand, but it won't quite let the catchers get a rope round its neck. So they're going to get a dart out and see if they can catch it that way.
The tranquilizer dart hits its target and the copper-coloured dog settles down in the grass and goes to sleep. The catching team move in and load the animal into a kennel.
Putting it back at Andre's. There's more dogs right next door. We're going to go get those dogs, and after Andre drops stuff off, he'll take this dog out. Yeah, there's more dogs right over here.
In the Soviet Union, the aftermath of the Chernobyl disaster was given unprecedented prominence on tonight's television news bulletin.
In the aftermath of the Chernobyl disaster in 1986, the people who lived near the nuclear power station were evacuated. But there were conditions attached.
They were told that they would only be gone for a couple of days, and they were told to leave all of their animals and pets behind.
That's Lucas Hickson from the Clean Futures Foundation that runs the Dogs of Chernobyl project.
The Soviet government sent in the military to cull the population of pets and domesticated animals like cows and horses that lived in this 30-kilometer exclusion zone. However, they were not completely successful, and so there's nearly 1,000 stray dogs in the zone when we started this program, and they're all descendants of these abandoned pets.
Lucas now works with a team of volunteers, catching the dogs and bringing them to a makeshift clinic next door to the old reactor.
So the first station when the dogs come in is into intake. The catch team brings them in. They're screened by the radiation safety team for external contamination, because the first thing we have to make sure is that people that are interacting with the dogs aren't being exposed to the dust and contamination that builds up on their fur.
So to be clear about this, the dogs that are here, are they radioactive?
So the dogs themselves are not radioactive. Radioactive is the contamination itself. They pick up contamination on their fur kind of like dirt. So in the same sense, we have to remove that from them. So, but they are themselves not radioactive.
So if you can get rid of the dust and the dirt off them,
exactly,
they're
like any other dog. Exactly.
Inside the clinic, we watch as the dogs are vaccinated, spayed or neutered, and then taken back to the part of the exclusion zone where they were caught and released.
There you go. It's a tough one.
Conci von Gontard is a volunteer from Florida.
You wish you could bring them home and have them all the perfect home, you know, like mine do, but we release them back into the community. But these dogs are community dogs, and they're taken care of, but in a much more loose sense than we would take care of, for instance, our personal pets.
There are thought to be about 600 Chernobyl dogs surviving on food given to them by workers inside the zone. Their life expectancy is short, just 4 years. But that's not because of the radiation. It's because winters here are cold and life is tough. This woman says that two of the dogs that she fed were taken by wolves last year.
It's difficult to see an animal that humans have purposefully bred and trained to be a specific way, you know, domesticated, then turned out on their own, abandoned in an environment that at every turn, it's like Watership Down, you know, with the rabbits. At every turn, something is out to get them.
Not all the dogs are released. Last year, for the first time, permission was given for 43 Chernobyl puppies to be adopted overseas.
She's such a blessing.
This is Chelsea from Florida, who adopted Noble.
I may get teased about having a dog from Chernobyl who might be radioactive and, you know, glow in the dark, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
This is Vodya. He's a cute guy.
Meet Jennifer in Pittsburgh and her dog, Vodya.
They survived. His descendants survived, and he is a survivor.
But adoption is not seen as a long-term solution. Plans are now being made for a possible dog sanctuary inside the exclusion zone. For Chernobyl's great survivors, it would be a place to rest their heads at last.
Jonah Fisher in Ukraine. A South African man who won an opportunity to be the first black African in space has died in a motorbike accident before fulfilling his dream. In 2013, Mandla Maseko was nicknamed Afronaut and Space Boy after winning a competition organized by a space academy in the United States. At the time, he told the BBC he wanted to do something that would motivate and inspire young people in Africa.
Like Neil Armstrong did, you know, he said one small step for man, one giant for mankind. So I'm hoping that by the time I call, I will have something that Africans would say, you know what, this guy said this while he was in space, and this is inspirational enough.
Will Ross has more details on Mandla Maseko.
Mandla Maseko described himself as a typical township boy from Pretoria who'd been taught to confront all challenges he faced head-on. The part-time DJ and member of the South African Air Force spent a week undergoing what he said were extremely tough tests at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. After winning the competition to go into space, he said he wanted to do something that would motivate and inspire young people in Africa and prove that they could achieve anything, whatever their background.
Will Ross. The Jodrell Bank Observatory in the northwest of England has been declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The observatory, which is part of the University of Manchester, has been at the forefront of astronomical research since it was founded in 1945. Our correspondent Andy Gill reports from there.
Rising from the green of the Cheshire Plain, the huge white disc of the Lovell Radio Telescope is the world-famous image of Jodrell Bank. The telescope was named after the physicist Sir Bernard Lovell, who pioneered the use of radio waves instead of visible light in astronomy. When it was built in 1945, it was the biggest radio telescope in the world and is still the third largest. But Jodrell Bank has been given World Heritage status not just for its dramatic looks, but for its contribution to our understanding of the universe. It tracked US and Russian craft during the space race.
0152 UT. Probe is about 1 hour's travel away from the moon.
And UNESCO says it's also helped to further the study of the moon, meteors and quasars.
Andy Gill. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.